From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Let's think now about the distant future, about a time when the world is run by robots. It's this week's Science Out of the Box. Those ruling androids will look back to pioneers of the robot revolution. Sojourner, the NASA rover that trekked over Mars. HAL, the bossy computer from 2001 A Space Odyssey. And they'll definitely look back to 2003 when the Robot Hall of Fame opened. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce stopped in Pittsburgh this week for this year's induction ceremony.
Right now, the Robot Hall of Fame has no physical hall you can walk through. That will come next year when the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh opens a new exhibit. Tonight, the center is just hosting a party. Right inside the door, guests are greeted by what seems to be an astonishing little robot called Quasi.
Oh, you guys want to hear some awesome robot jokes?
Yeah.
What do you call a robot who's always getting lost? R2-D-Tor.
It's amazing how many people think, wow, artificial intelligence has really come of age. It's like, no, it's an actor. There's an actor behind it.
Don Marinelli says Quasi is not actually a robot. It's a high-tech puppet. Marinelli is a drama professor at Carnegie Mellon University, which founded the Robot Hall of Fame. He says people are so used to seeing robots in movies and TV that they now have totally unrealistic expectations of what a robot should be able to do in real life. So this was the first controversy faced by the builders of the Robot Hall of Fame. Should they include famous fake robots or just real ones?
There was a real concern that the fictional robots would skew people's expectations so that when they saw a robot that did widgets, it would seem somehow less impressive than Gort, which could incinerate the Earth.
Gort, of course, is from the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still. And he's in the Hall of Fame, because it turns out the Hall will accept fantasy robots, along with real-world ones, like Unimate, the first industrial robot. It did dull, repetitive work on a GM assembly line in 1961. Marinelli is on a jury of distinguished scientists and artists who get together every year to decide what else should be in the Hall.
There is definitely tension and conflict when it comes to deciding who should get in first.
One exception was when jury member Arthur C. Clarke nominated one of his own fictional creations.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
No one said, I can't do that to Clarke, even though Hal is usually considered a computer.
Nobody was willing to say, but Sir Arthur... Hal is a lens and a red light. I mean, we didn't want to go there. It was like, sure, Hal, why not?
Sometimes robots that don't win can feel hurt.
And rather cruelly, R2-D2 was one of the first inductees.
Anthony Daniels says it was cruel because he played the other famous Star Wars robot, C-3PO, the tall golden one that wasn't in the first group of inductees. He says C-3PO wasn't bitter exactly.
He just noted it and was a little silent when R2 came home boasting with his memorial plaque that he'd been given. But always right the next year.
That's because the next year, C-3PO got in too. And now, the man inside the gold suit serves as master of ceremonies.
For the Robot Hall of Fame, Anthony Daniels!
This year, only one fictional invention got in. Lieutenant Commander Data from Star Trek. He was joined by real robots, like Mindstorms, the popular Lego kit, plus NavLab 5. That's a high-tech minivan that drove itself from Pittsburgh to San Diego in 1995. Another inductee was the Raybert Hopper, a one-legged robot invented by Mark Raybert in the early 1980s.
All it does is hop around in a lab, go back and forth.
But Raybert says the Hopper pioneered new ideas about balance and motion that let other robots walk in a much more natural way. So even though this electronic pogo stick will look incredibly humble next to famous sci-fi characters in the Robot Hall of Fame, it's just the kind of real-world technology that might someday make them a reality. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This month, the U.S. Army will issue handheld screening devices
to soldiers in Afghanistan. Those devices will be used to question suspects in crisis situations, like roadside bomb sites, so that Army personnel might determine whose account to trust. The technology used is not even as exact as those in polygraphs. Will using the machines endanger innocent people or let U.S. soldiers be fooled? Donald Crapole is Special Assistant to the Director at the Defense Academy for Credibility Assessment at Fort Jackson Army Installation in Columbia, South Carolina. That's where the military trains personnel on how to conduct tests. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
And how do these things work?
They are essentially computerized devices that record physiology, and they have an algorithm to analyze the physiological data, which produces a screen indicating that the person has reacted consistently to the relevant questions, that they've not reacted consistently to the relevant questions, or you have an inconclusive result.
Now, when you talk about that data, what is that exactly? Breaking into a sweat, rolling your eyes?
The device uses two separate channels. One is called photoplethysmograph, which its function is to record changes in capillary dilation at the tips of the fingers. And the second one records very subtle changes that occur in perspiration on the surface of the skin.
And so what? Soldiers will ask what kind of question?
There would be technical questions for baseline material, and then there would be relevant questions that really depend on what the application might be.
Give us an example of a baseline question, if you could, because we've all seen lie detectors used in movies.
It's not a lie detector. In fact, a real lie detector doesn't even exist. The closest thing I ever knew to a lie detector was my mother. But there might be test questions such as, is today Saturday? There might be an overall question such as, do you intend to be truthful to all of the questions here today?
I've read that the Pentagon estimates these devices are between 82 and 90% accurate. Is that high enough?
As a screening device, it's actually quite good, as long as one understands that it's not a standalone technology. In fact, regulations prohibit its use as the final determination for anything. It's designed to help decision makers make wiser decisions about the credibility of the individuals that they encounter.
Now, is there a bias built in which would make a suspicious finding, a red light, if you please, more common?
The algorithm is risk-averse, which means that it's going to be better at detecting liars than it does truth-tellers. And the best analogy I've ever heard for that is the standard TB test that I think most of us have taken. If it turns red, then you have failed the screening test. Now, there are lots of reasons for having that little spot in your arm turn red, some of them unrelated to TB. We think of the PCAS, to use maybe a crude analogy, is like the TB test. If the red shows up on your arm, that would indicate that you need more scrutiny, but it's not sufficient in and of itself to take any direct action.
Are these devices, and I want to note they're called PCASs, are they being used anywhere in this country now in peacetime conditions, highway patrol or something?
The device was developed by the Department of Defense for a specific application, which is in right now perhaps Iraq and Afghanistan. It is not authorized for use on U.S. citizens.
What do you say perhaps to an Afghan citizen who would say, how come you're willing to use them on us but not your own people?
The challenge has been that there are simply not enough polygraph examiners in all of the federal government to meet the needs of our commanders overseas. If there were enough polygraph examiners, then we would be using that technology because, as one might expect, it has better accuracy. But resources being what they are, rather than to leave our troops with no assistance, we've taken the path of providing at least some technical support for them with the understanding that it's designed only for that application and only in that setting.
But again, what's the answer for someone from Afghanistan?
And I guess I could give that person the very long answer and have to leave it up to him to determine whether what I'm saying is true or not.
Well, Mr. Crapole, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Donald Crapole, Special Assistant to the Director of the Defense Academy for Credibility Assessment in Columbia, South Carolina.
We can't get enough of this Microsoft Yahoo saga. There hasn't actually been a deal yet, but there's been plenty of news. Here's the latest. Newspapers are reporting that the Microsoft CEO, Steve Ballmer, may enlist News Corp CEO Rupert Murdoch in his bid to buy Yahoo. An alliance might allow Microsoft to increase its asking price, putting more pressure on Yahoo's shareholders to say yes. Executives at the internet company still want to escape a takeover if they can, and they are talking with Time Warner's AOL. Yesterday, Yahoo announced a test alliance with its rival Google. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more on that.
The test is small, affecting no more than 3% of Yahoo search queries and lasting no more than 2 weeks. But it raises the specter of a bigger and broader partnership between Yahoo, which has one of the most visited sites on the web, and Google, the clear leader in search and the ad revenue that goes with it. Yahoo believes that by using ads selected and delivered by Google, it may be able to make more money from advertising. As analyst Derek Brown of the Wall Street firm Cantor Fitzgerald explains, searches done using Google generate more advertising revenue per query than searches done on Yahoo.
The question that Yahoo hopes to answer through this is, how much more revenue and thus profit can Yahoo generate by displaying Google ads than by displaying their own ads?
What happens after the test period is anyone's guess. Neither Google nor Yahoo would speculate, but Microsoft was quick to chime in. Within minutes of Yahoo's announcement yesterday, Microsoft issued a statement saying, quote, "Any definitive agreement between Yahoo and Google would consolidate over 90% of the search advertising market in Google's hands." The statement continued, "This would make the market far less competitive, in sharp contrast to our own proposal to acquire Yahoo." The battle over Yahoo's future continues. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.